Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is peace possible between Israelis and Palestinians? And if it is, why have so many past efforts failed to achieve it? My guest today sincerely believes the opposing sides can be brought together, but that it will require them both to examine their respective roles in the suffering and violence that have plagued the region since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Rabbi Michael Lerner is founder and publisher of Tikkun magazine. His new book is called Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Peace Center. Welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rabbi Lerner, you believe it is possible to be both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine. That is a very upsetting idea to many people.
I know that, but actually the truth is the only way to really be pro-Israel is to also be pro-Palestine. And the only way to be pro-Palestine is to be also pro-Israel, because these two people's fate is totally intertwined. There is no solution, no possible solution for Israel that won't simultaneously achieve security and respect for the Palestinian people. And there is no way that the Palestinian people can ever achieve security and respect without giving the same and helping the Israelis achieve the same for themselves. These two people are just, I mean, it would be, imagine if you tried to have a struggle between Fort Worth and Dallas. I mean, that's the amount of territory we're talking about is almost like that. It's not very, it's a really small territory. And you're not going to ever be able to settle that issue unless both sides get what they need.
Well, and I imagine you've heard this argument before. People will say, well, I could imagine myself being respectful to the other side, but I can't trust that those guys will behave themselves.
Yes. And that's one of the fundamentals that has to be addressed in this whole struggle, is that each side has a tendency to demonize the other and to assume that the other really, they really aren't like normal human beings. And this tendency to not be able to see the other as equally created in the image of God — I'm speaking as a rabbi, so I talk in that language — is really at the root of this this whole conflict, not being able to recognize the humanity of the other. And so a first step really is to try to confront and challenge the beliefs that people have that the other side is a fundamentally different creature, not like us. And so I can't tell you how many times in the Jewish world I've been told, you just don't know what Arabs are like. They're really different. They really don't think the way we do, and so forth. And how many times in the times I've been in Palestine, people will tell me, you know, these Jews are so mean and hurtful and violent that there's no way we can ever make peace with them.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. You do not call it a history per se, but you go back and look at the reasons why today people are locked in what feel like really intractable emotions. We'll start, for no particular reason, with the perspective of the Palestinians, who at the time that the State of Israel was being formed were especially concerned. They were still sort of healing from the legacy of European imperialism.
Right. Well, European imperialism, colonialism was going on. They weren't really quite healing from it, because it was happening all over the Middle East, all over Africa, all over Asia. And it wasn't their fantasy when they saw these European countries dividing up Africa, Asia, the Middle East, creating states that had never existed before. For example, creating Saudi Arabia, picking a king who would be on their on the side of the British, and then giving him the money and arms to suppress the rest of the people in Saudi Arabia so that he could be their leader, and in exchange give European and American companies access to the oil there without them having to pay what would be a reasonable amount for the people who live there. In fact, Americans many times think about the Middle East countries and say, what are those Arabs living on top of our oil? Mm-hmm. as though we owned it. So, yes, there was a reality for the Arab world of colonialism and imperialism happening. The mistake was to see us, the Jews who were coming from Europe, as though we were representatives of those colonial countries, when actually we were fleeing from those colonial countries because we had been the primary victim of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to get away from them as quickly as possible. But nevertheless, we represented in their eyes, through the perception of their history, particularly the Crusades and so forth, the reality of Westerners coming and really hurting or oppressing them.
And on the other side, you had Jews, particularly those who had survived the Holocaust and made it to Israel, really in no emotional position to consider anyone's pain but their own.
Exactly. We jumped from the burning buildings of Europe, and we didn't set the fire. It was the history of Christianity, which for some 1,700 years had been beating up on Jews, killing Jews around every Good Friday, because the Christian text blamed the Jews, not just the Jews of the ancient world, but Jews continuously from then on as being the ones who had killed Jesus. And actually, we had better relationships and we were safer in Muslim lands because the Muslims didn't think we had killed Muhammad, mm-hmm. which was a very good thing for us Jews. But then that hatred, the history of hatred in Christian Europe of Jews, created the foundation for the Nazis to come to power and use the traditional cultural hatred of Jews as a means to manipulate people into thinking that their problem was the Jewish people. And as a result, one out of every three Jews alive in the 20th century was murdered. But one out of every three. So, I mean, this was an incredible catastrophe. Imagine if in 9/11, instead of 3,000 Americans killed, and you know how what a trauma that was for us, what if 100 million Americans had been killed? Well, imagine the trauma we would be living here today under a military regime, because people would be that so traumatized. So the Jews faced incredible trauma that I know most of my family was wiped out, and many, 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 many families, both in America and in Europe, had their families wiped out. So the trauma was real, and it was reinforced by the previous 1,700 years of oppression. Of course, we would see things through the framework of that trauma. And conversely, when we created the State of Israel in 1948, many Arabs fled because they thought that the war would be over quickly. But many other Arabs, many other Palestinians were pushed out of their home by physical force from the Israeli army at the time. And something that most of us who grew up in the Jewish world didn't even know until the 1990s, when the Israeli archives were opened and Israeli historians wrote about the actual role of how this tremendous tragedy for the Palestinian people, what we call the Nakba or the catastrophe, how that happened to the Palestinians. It wasn't just listening to their leaders and fleeing. Some were, but a lot were also physically pushed out or else ran as a result of the terrorist attacks by the major terrorist organizations in the Jewish world, which were led by Yitzhak Shamir and by Menachem Begin, two men who later became prime ministers of the State of Israel.
So what you describe really on both sides is a sort of social form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes. And I was in Israel, I lived many years in Israel in various capacities, usually taking care of my son, whom I sent to high school there, and then also taking care of him while he was in the Israeli army. He was in the paratroopers, a very scary thing, jumping out of these airplanes. And I did research there. Before I became a rabbi, I was a psychologist. And so doing research on the psychodynamics of Israeli society, just as I had previously done on the psychodynamics of American society. And I found that the trauma was so deep in people, both in Israel and in Palestine, that we could only call it post-traumatic stress disorder on a societal level. Now, on an individual level, we already know, let's say a woman gets raped, and months later, even years later, she feels unsafe going out at night. She feels scared about being with men that she doesn't know. This is what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. You can't cure that by saying to her, listen, the guy who raped you is in jail. You don't have anything to fear about anymore, because the trauma has been so intense that it shapes her perception. Now, so you can't talk somebody out of that, and you can't scare somebody out of that. You have to nurture somebody out of that over time and giving people time. Now, when you have a whole society, two societies, the Palestinian society and the Israeli society, filled with people who have suffered this trauma and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, then you've got a real formula for conflict. And that conflict is not going to disappear by simply rational means of saying to them, hey, Hitler is dead. Hey, we're no longer pushing you out of your land like that. It doesn't work that way.
So, Rabbi, PTSD may be somewhat different, but by definition, mental illness is a condition in which people who suffer often don't recognize that they are suffering.
Absolutely. And in PTSD, unlike other mental conditions in which we normally think of the person suffering as having brought it on themselves by some internal process, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is something where it acknowledges from the start that there really was a trauma. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a trauma that was made up by the person going through it.
Someone or something has caused it.
Something has really caused it outside yourself. And that something both cases is huge. And yes, the people who suffer from it often will deny it and say, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm a rational being. But then you look at their choices, and the choices are very irrational. And that's part of what I talk about in this book, is that both sides are unable to see the humanity of the other. And hence, each side has acted in ways that have often been cruel and insensitive to the needs of the other. And that has confirmed on the other side their worst fantasy of who they're dealing with. So each side continually acts in ways that confirm the worst fantasies of the most extreme vision of who they are by the other side.
So it's hard enough to break that cycle when you are dealing with individuals. What do you do when you're dealing with a whole society where even if a certain segment says, yes, I'm ready to acknowledge this and heal and move forward, you have lots of other people in both cases, in fact, the majority of other people in those societies unwilling to do anything different?
Well, we need to create step by step a solution that is aimed at reaffirming the capacity of people to see the other as a real human being. So in the book, the first thing that I do is I tell the story. But there are so many books that will tell the story from the standpoint of the Jews are the righteous victims and the Palestinians are the evil others. Or, more recently, I've read many books that tell the story the opposite way. The Palestinians are the righteous victims and the Jews are the evil other. And what my book tries to do is to tell the story in such a way that you can see that both sides have a legitimate discourse, that both sides have a story that really is totally understandable, and you can and how to understand the ways that each saw the other as evil through the framework of their historical understanding. And so that's a first step, is teaching people how to see in that way. And that's why I wrote the book, as part of the reason. But that's not sufficient. That's a first step. And there are more steps. We need to then combat the worldview that comes out of the West just as much as out of the Middle East, that says that the only way to achieve homeland security, to be safe in this world, is to dominate others, to have power over others. This strategy of domination, which has been with us for 6,000 years, at least, or 7,000 years in world history, has only produced more wars and more domination.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Rabbi Michael Lerner, founder and publisher of Tikkun Magazine. His new book is called Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He's in town to speak this evening to the Dallas Peace Center. The address starts at 7 at the Roger Kallenberg. It is the Roger Kallenberg Spring Lecture at the Unity Church of Dallas. If you'd like more information, you can find it at dallaspeacecenter.org. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Rabbi Michael Lerner is my guest this hour. He is in town to deliver the Dallas Peace Center's 8th Annual Roger Kallenberg Spring Lecture. It starts at 7 tonight at the Unity Church of Dallas. You can learn more at dallaspeacecenter.org. He's got a new book out as well called Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here that says, I would love for the rabbi to comment on the impact American Jews have on the political situation in Israel, specifically those who immigrate to Israel and form the radical right and inhabit and pursue settlements.
Yeah, it's certainly true that the radical right wasn't created by American Jews, but there are many American Jews who have gone there and played some of the most extremist roles in the settlements. And I believe that this is another response to the trauma that Jews have gone through, is that for American Jews, there are many who have feelings of guilt that that American Jews didn't do enough during the Second World War to save their fellow Jews. It was the case that during the Second World War, one of the reasons why Jews all over the world feel that they need a homeland and need it is that while we were being murdered in the millions in Europe, no other country opened their gates to those who were successful in fleeing. And so there were boatloads of refugees who came to the shores of the United States and were turned back. They weren't allowed to come here. And there was no other country that let them in. So that was a time when one might have hoped that the several million Jews who were in this country, there were still about 4 million Jews at the time in this country, would have engaged in massive civil disobedience against our government, demanding that it let Jews in. But Jews did not do that. There were some demonstrations, but not very much in the way of real confrontation, because, of course, we were very grateful for our armies fighting against the Nazis in Europe. But there was a residual guilt that has led many Jews to feel like, I was too passive in the past. Now we've got to show that we're not passive anymore, that we're strong. And so there has been a kind of Jewish complex after the Second World War about the issue of strength. How strong are you? How powerful are you? We were weak. We didn't fight back enough. It's not true that we didn't fight back in Europe, because many Jews did, but most didn't. And so so Jews have played a bad role there. And similarly, the American Jewish community here has had many institutions and many organizations that have taken the line of whatever Israel says, that's right. And it doesn't matter what the government, how crazy the government is. Now, and if you critique, as a Jew, if you critique the government in the United States, you're treated as though you are a disloyal Jew or a self-hating Jew or an anti-Semite. And so that really represses a lot of the ethics of younger Jews, who often say, well, if you say that, then maybe I am, and maybe I don't want to be part of the Jewish community anymore. And so this Jewish community, by acting that way as the cheerleader for every government in Israel, has ended up undermining itself with its own youth.
At the same time, you have said this question of the right of return for Palestinians is something that will not happen under any circumstance.
As a right of return, meaning that the entire Palestinian people, who were 800,000 when they were pushed out but now are 4 million living around the world, to make that the demand is impossible for Israel, because the Jewish people still feel vulnerable enough to feel that we absolutely need a homeland that is ours. Whenever we have lived in other countries, we've ended up in situations in which we've been treated poorly, if not oppressively. That's how many, many Jews think, and for that reason, they're not going to concede the right of return, which would turn Israel into a Jewish minority. On the other hand, in the proposals that I put forward in the book of what would be the terms of a settlement, one part of the terms is for Israel to acknowledge partial responsibility for the Palestinian people's refugees. Partial because we did not entirely cause that situation. In fact, if you want to see the history, you'll see how Britain and the United States and France, the colonial countries, set up people against each other, particularly Britain set the peoples against each other wherever they were, all over the world. But in Palestine, they set Jews against Palestinians and Palestinians against Jews. So yes, we have to acknowledge partial responsibility. And I think that's part of what Palestinians are asking for when they say the right of return. Because when you do polls with Palestinians, most of them say, no, I don't want to go back there. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to live there. But in the plan that I put forward for a peace settlement, which is in the book, I call for Israel to accept 20,000 Palestinians a year to return for each year for the next 30 years. Knowing that that number of Palestinians will not, in other words, eventually 600,000, will not destroy the population balance. It will not be a threat to making Israel a primarily Arab state, but it will be a symbol of generosity and an acknowledgement and an act of atonement and repentance for our part of that struggle. Now, I think Palestinians also had a part in that, and that they should also take some steps of acknowledgement and atonement. But on the other hand, when you have two peoples fighting, and one has an army, an air force, and a navy, and the other has nothing but rocks and some rifles, now some in Gaza some missiles that never hit their target, thank God. There's a vast disproportion in power, and the more powerful should be the more generous in any settlement. So I call on Israel to take first steps, but only steps that are consistent with Israeli security, because I want Israel to be safe and secure. But the basic thesis of this book is that the only way Israel will be safe and secure is through replacing the strategy of domination with a strategy of generosity towards the Palestinian people and open-heartedness. And that, by the way, is my view about how America can be safe in the world when we replace our strategy of domination with a strategy of generosity.
One thing you propose is a sort of two-state solution in which both populations are physically overlapping. Where you live geographically doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your nationality or your citizenship, I should say.
Well, that's definitely one possible solution, and it's a variant of a two-state solution that is being worked on by Israelis right now. And I put it forward as one possible way to conceive of a two-state solution in which the Arabs living inside the pre-67 borders of Israel would vote in and be citizens of the Palestinian state, and Israelis living in the pre-67 Jordan, which was included the West Bank, people who are living there, are able to vote in the Israeli elections and retain their Israeli citizenship. I think that's a complicated arrangement, and I am myself waiting for the Israelis who have proposed this to work out the details, because I'm not sure how that would work on the local level. But I am very much for a two-state solution in which each people gets the right of their own national self-determination. And I think that when that happens, Palestinians are going to feel like they're getting the respect that they have been denied for such a long time and continue to be denied by the policies of the United States and Israel in not allowing them to become a member of the United Nations.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll start with Radwan in Dallas. Hi, Radwan.
Yes, hi there, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to you all the time. Rabbi, first of all, thank you so much. I happen to be a Muslim, and I wanted to say, first of all, shalom aleichem.
Aleichem shalom.
Thank you. And honestly, sir, this is the first time I see such refreshing talk about this issue, and you bring a lot of things out to the light, and thank you so much for speaking the truth. Rabbi, if you don't mind, I know, you know, your heart is in the right place. So are you, the liking of you other rabbis, what steps are they doing in order to close the gap between the Palestinians and the Muslim and the Israeli in that area. And the second question is, do you think this is a religious issue, or does this have to do with Zionism in comparison to the political side of Muslims in that region? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, so two things to say on that. The first thing is that we in Tikkun have created an interfaith organization that is Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, and also welcoming to secular humanists and atheists. And it's called the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And you can find it on the web at spiritualprogressives.org. spiritualprogressives.org. And we have put forward there a campaign to challenge the negativity on both sides. And we work directly with a group in Israel called Rabbis for Human Rights. And the Rabbis for Human Rights are working with groups like the Bethlehem Peace Center that is teaching nonviolence. We're very deeply committed to nonviolence for both sides and believe that the strategy of violence is a disaster. That's part of what a domination worldview leads to. There are many, many other projects in Israel of bringing Israelis and Palestinians together for dialogue. And many of those projects have a big impact on the small numbers of people who go to them. But you have to understand that as long as violence is happening from both sides against the other side, that the vast majority of people on both sides are going to be very scared to cross over the lines between people. So that's one thing to say, and we are working on that, and I would like to invite anybody who is listening to this who thinks, yeah, I'd like to have that voice of that rabbi and more Jewish people speaking the way he's speaking, to please come and join our network of spiritual progressives at spiritualprogressives.org. And reading, if you're not ready to join something, read our magazine. Subscribe to Tikkun. Tikkun is TIKKUN.org. It's Tikkun is a word that means healing, repair, and transformation. And we started out as a Jewish magazine, but now we've evolved into both Jewish and interfaith magazine. And I think you'll find it. But I don't believe that it's a religious issue. I mean, that, I don't believe it's just a Zionist or political issue. It's a religious issue in the following way, that if you're a religious person, as I am, then you have to take seriously the claim of the Bible that human beings are created in the image of God. And it doesn't say Jews are created in the image of God, or Christians, or Muslims. Every human being is created in the image of God. And consequently, every human being is equally precious in God's eyes. So when I hear people talking on one side or the other as though they didn't care about the suffering of the other side, I say, you're rejecting the fundamental religious belief. So yes, it's a religious issue in that sense. It's a religious issue. For me, it means that I have to care equally about the preciousness and the humanity of the Palestinian people as I do about the preciousness and humanity of my own people, the Jews.
You use very strong language in the book. You say that the militant Israeli response to Palestinian protest violates international standards of human rights and makes a mockery, those are your words, of the highest values of Jewish tradition. Does that account for why so many Jews look at you and say you're a traitor to what we're trying to do?
Well, you know, mockery is a is a soft word compared to what our prophets were saying about their fellow Jews. I have to say that I was nurtured on Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, from age 12. I was reading him every week, and I am very much inspired by that tradition. And that tradition, you know, Isaiah stands in front of the temple and says to the Jews, to his fellow Jews, stop bringing these sacrifices. I detest your Yom Kippur. I detest your holidays, says God, because at the same time that you are fasting, you are oppressing the poor, and you are not clothing the naked. You are not finding shelter for the homeless. You are not taking care of the orphan and the widow, the powerless ones. So I think I'm relatively tame in the prophetic tradition. I'm not claiming to be a prophet. nonprofit, God forbid, but I am claiming that I'm influenced by that. And when you're talking to your own family, you sometimes feel a little use language that's a lot stronger than you might use for others outside.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Henry in Dallas. Hello, Henry.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Hi.
Appreciate you with that book. I'm going to have to read it. I just wanted to say that my mom have told me stories when she lived in Nablus in Palestine, and we are Muslims, by the way. She said that they had, or they used to celebrate all religions mm-hmm. in Nablus. And my grandmother used to send her over on the days of Passover to the neighbor to light the stove so they can cook. Mm. Because they were not allowed to set fire,
right.
Let's say. And, you know, it's really sad that before the Nakba, you know, everybody lived in peace. I mean, they coexisted. And I do not understand that. How could we separate ourselves as Muslims, Christians, and Jews, considering that it's one religion, one God? And here we are fighting under the name of God.
Yes.
While it's all one religion, really.
Yes, it is. And I totally agree with you that it's tragic. On the other hand, I don't want to idealize the relationship that existed before 1948, because the truth is that in while Jews were much better off in Islamic lands than we were in Christian lands, nevertheless, we lived in relatively apartheid-like conditions in which we were second-class citizens and did not have the same rights as Muslims. And even in the Holy Land, particularly in the years before the Nakba, the Palestinian National Movement did its best to convince the British through their influence with other Arab states to not allow Jews to come to the land of Palestine when we were fleeing Nazi Germany. And so the gates were closed to Palestine because the Palestinian National Movement didn't let us come. And that caused a great deal of resentment amongst Jews towards the Palestinian people because there was no place to go.
My guest is Rabbi Michael Lerner, founder and publisher of Tikkun Magazine. His new book is called Embracing Israel-Palestine, The Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He'll speak this evening to the Dallas Peace Center. We'll come back to the conversation in about 2 minutes. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rabbi Michael Lerner, author of the new book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He's in town to speak this evening at 7 to the Dallas Peace Center. You can find more information about that at dallaspeacecenter.org. To join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Another solution that you have proposed is that you allow Jews to stay in the settlements where they are now. You allow Israelis to stay where they are. However, Jews that stay in what are now called the occupied territories would have to give up their Israeli citizenship and agree to abide by Palestinian law.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same way that Palestinians who live inside Israel had to give up their Jordanian citizenship and become Israelis. Mm-hmm. And they live under Israeli rule and they vote in Israeli elections. And so that's different than the other idea of overlapping constituencies. Mm-hmm. The one that I think is most practical is this one that would allow Israelis to stay. I'm not in favor of uprooting people from the settlements. I am in favor of giving them strong financial incentives to move back to Israel. Mm-hmm. But for those who believe that the Jewish people have a right to the entire land of Israel because they religiously believe that that is their entitlement from the Torah, from the Bible, then they should be able to stay there. But the Bible doesn't say anything about states or national citizenship. So yes, let them live in Palestine, but as Palestinian citizens and obeying Palestinian rules, and not expecting that Israel is going to intervene every time they feel that something has been done incorrectly. Just as it would have been not the case that the other Arab states could intervene in Israel when, for the first 10 years after the creation of the State of Israel, the entire Palestinian people living in Israel lived under martial law.
What would be an appropriate role for international peacekeepers in that situation?
Well, you see, let me say, I'll answer the question, but I want to make a point here, is that although I lay out some of the details of, and in fact call for Palestinian, an international force composed both of Israelis and Palestinians and internationals to protect both states from the extremists of the other side, because no matter what solution you're going to come up with, there are going to be extremists on the other side who will try to incite violence again.
Within the two societies.
Within the two societies. You'll have Israelis who want to incite violence and attack Palestine, and you'll have Palestinians who want to incite violence. So you'll have that, but instead of calling that a national struggle, we'll call that a police force that needs to deal with this, not a police action, not a national struggle action.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I want to emphasize that a core belief in my book is that no political settlement will work unless there is a fundamental change of consciousness, and that the idea that you hear in the media that the peace people are trying to push to get back into negotiations, and oh, if we only could get people to sit down and negotiate again. No, the negotiations, whatever they come up with, if they ever did come up with anything, aren't worth the paper they're printed on until there is a change in the feelings that people have about each other. And this gets me back to the strategy of generosity. And in fact, being able to respond to others in a different way than through domination or power over. So that's why I propose in the book that ultimately this change of consciousness in which we are sure that the other is going to hurt us has to start in the West. We have to – in the United States, we could make a tremendous contribution to Israeli-Palestinian peace. But it's not by what we propose at a peace table. It's by how we live. If we ourselves in the United States were to give up our strategy of domination and instead embrace a strategy of generosity, and I put this forward towards the end of the book in what we call a global Marshall Plan, in which the United States would take the leadership with the other advanced industrial countries to dedicate 1% to 2% of our gross domestic product each year for the next 20, to once and for all end, not ameliorate, but end global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care, both in the United States and starting with the Middle East, starting with Israel-Palestine, but extending to the rest of the Middle East and then to the rest of the world. We would do far more to achieve homeland security through that kind of strategy of generosity. Plus, if we'd also have to change our economic arrangements with other countries, because right now we have dominated them with economic arrangements that benefit us and hurt the domestic farmers in many of the poor countries around the world, which in turn generates these people coming from South America and Central America trying to get across our borders, because that wasn't happening 40 years ago. There weren't millions of people coming. They're coming now because through NAFTA and other international arrangements that we made, we have eliminated their possibility of making a living in their own country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have on the line in Fort Worth, Bob. Hello, Bob.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Rabbi Lerner.
Hi.
Couple questions. Have you spoken with Benjamin Netanyahu about your plan? Do you think Hamas and Netanyahu are too inflexible to accomplish peace? And I thought that you mentioned the settlement. apologize for my ignorance. I thought that the settlement issue is probably the nail in the coffin of any sort of peace plan. And that's all.
Thanks for your call, Bob.
It doesn't have to be the nail in the coffin if the people who live in those settlements are willing to live as citizens of a Palestinian state. So there is a way of solving that problem. Netanyahu and Hamas right now are the extremes on each side. You're not going to get them to accept this kind of a plan or this kind of a consciousness until we get a change of consciousness in a much broader way. I'm not looking forward to or believing in the conversion of either Hamas or the extreme right in Israel. What I do believe is that most Israelis and most Palestinians would no longer give their allegiance to the extremists if there was a viable middle path that was both in their interest and in the interest of the other side. So we have to foster that. But in order to foster that, we ourselves have to be embodiments of that. We have to create a new spirit in the West that says, yes, we recognize, and this is critical for our survival in the 21st century as Americans, we have to recognize that our well-being as Americans depends on the well-being of everyone else on the planet. And I'm looking forward to the day when the President of the United States ends his State of the Union address by saying, God bless America and every other nation on this planet. Okay, because our fates are all intertwined, and that is absolutely the case in Israel-Palestine. So we have to build a new consciousness in the world, and we can do that starting here. We can overcome our fear of the world and begin to recognize that it's by treating others in a loving and caring way that we're going to get love and caring back, and that the road to peace is a road of peace.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phones, we speak with Ken in Arlington. Hi, Ken.
Yes, good afternoon, Chris and Rabbi.
Hi.
I worked in the Middle East for 3 years, and I enjoyed it. But the noise that comes out of Israel indicates to me that they will never, never give up the West Bank. I think we have to accept that political reality. Now, recently, an Israeli member of government of their parliament, he valued the West Bank at $20 billion. And I think there's a solution here. I think Israel should pay the Palestinians $20 billion for the West Bank and give them about 4,000 square miles on the eastern border in the Negev Desert. And the present West Bank is 2,850 square miles. So the Palestinians would get a homeland on the eastern border of Israel of 4,000 square miles. And that $20 billion can also be used to buy additional land in the Sinai from Egypt, probably another 4,000 square miles. So this would give the Palestinians 8,000 square miles, which would make them the largest country in that area. And so a financial solution. Now, I realize it's a largely desert country, and so we have free natural gas from Saudi Arabia. That's a possibility. Saudi Arabia gives free natural gas, and you desalinate the ocean, and you produce fresh water, and you irrigate it, and you make that desert green. And this would be a solution which would give a homeland to the Palestinians and let the Israelis have the West Bank.
Ken, thank you so much for your call. He makes it sound so very simple. What do you think, Rabbi Lerner?
Well, just ask yourself I know some people in Northern California, where I live, who think that the solution to the struggle between red states and blue states is to give Texas some land in Mexico and move the population of those red staters down to Mexico so it doesn't have to be. And I know that there is somebody one of your governors here proposed the secession as one possible solution. So
I think that was a joke, but
it was continue. A joke, but yes. But how do you think the Texans would respond to that? Not so well.
Yeah.
The Palestinians, this is their home. They're not about to move. So I don't believe that is a viable solution. On the other hand, I'm not going to speak for the Palestinian people. I think that the issue is not the details. We have many plans that could work. The issue is the change of heart. And this is why I urge you to read this book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, which, by the way, is on Kindle, so you can get it through Amazon.com. If your local bookstore doesn't handle it, ask them to order it from Random House, the Random House distributors, or go to our website, tikkun.org.
I think our folks can find it, yeah. And we have information on the website as well. I want to talk, if you don't mind, a little bit about your personal journey, because you write about the fact that you were raised by parents who were prominent American Zionists. And in fact, you met as a young man and as a child many of the key players in the foundation of the State of Israel.
Yes. And I have to say that I didn't know anything about the situation of the Palestinian people. I grew up in a community that basically just assumed the Palestinians were the bad guys. And I never questioned it until I started studying for the rabbinate. And then I lived in Israel. And the first kibbutz that I worked on, I asked them, well, who lived here before the kibbutz was started? And they said, oh, yeah, well, there were these Arab villagers and they moved. And then I found out, no, they didn't just move. They were tossed off their land. And so I began to question, but still I didn't really want to question too much because I didn't want to be in struggle with Israel because I love Israel. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I brought my son to live there and then signed permission for my son to be in the Israeli army because he's an only child, and an only child can't be in a combat unit, which is what he was going into, without the parents' approval. So so funny when people in the Jewish world say, oh, he's a self-hating Jew because he believes in the rights of Palestinians. I say, yeah, I'd like to see how many American Jews send their kids to serve in the army, Israeli army. Anyway, no, I don't believe that there is any real solution here that doesn't involve a fundamental transformation of consciousness. And, you know, in Israel, the big fear is of being a frayer. And frayer means, in Hebrew, it means somebody who's always going to be taken advantage of. And Jews feel that they're always going to be taken advantage of unless we have a great deal of power. And frankly, I don't want to put any of my people down. I understand after the trauma of the Holocaust how people felt like God didn't come stand up for us, and therefore we have to stand up for ourselves and believe in our military power, our strength, rather than in our hearts. But unfortunately, that goes against the Jewish religion. The Jewish religion teaches, I mean, the most frequently repeated quote in Torah is, if you come, variants of the following, when you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger. Remember that you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And it also says unequivocally, thou shalt love the stranger. Okay. Jews have to live up to that. We have to go for that part of our own religious heritage. And to do that means to change overcome our fear, even though we came through it legitimately. And I have tremendous compassion for my people, for the fears that we have, but we must heal from those fears.
Will this happen in your son's lifetime, if not your own? We have just a few seconds left.
Absolutely. It will. And I believe that if the people in Dallas would work with us in the network of spiritual progressives and in Tikkun, we could make a big change in this country, which would help make a big change in the Middle East.
The new book by Rabbi Michael Lerner is called Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East. He's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Peace Center. It's the 8th annual Roger Kallenberg Spring Lecture, and it takes place at 7 o'clock at Unity Church of Dallas. Find information at dallaspeacecenter.org. Rabbi Lerner, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for being here and doing this wonderful show that you do.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And the senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.